Aldo Leopold once wrote, "I'm glad I will not be young in a future without wilderness. It's partly due to his work that our children don't have to face that future." It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa Week continues today, and this hour we're going to focus on some of Iowa's most influential conservationists. We'll start with Native son Aldo Leopold, whose words are still shaping the modern environmental movement more than 60 years after his death. We'll also talk about the life and work of Ernest Oberholzer, John Lacey, Ada Hayden, and Lewis Pamel. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa Week continues today, and all this week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we're telling the stories of innovative, influential, and remarkable Iowans. This hour, we're going to focus on some of Iowa's most influential conservationists. We did dedicate an entire hour to Ding Darling just about a year ago, so we've chosen to focus this hour on other Iowa conservationists, and we're going to start with Aldo Leopold, who was born in Burlington, Iowa in 1887. Leopold's seminal work, A Sand County Almanac, along with other work on ecology and conservation, has just been published in a new Library of America volume, and Kurt Miney is the editor of that collection. He's also a Leopold biographer and senior fellow for the Center for Humans and Nature and the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Hello, Kurt.
Good morning, Charity. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today.
I'm delighted, and it's always good to say hi to all my friends in Iowa.
Well, let's go back to Aldo Leopold's early life in Iowa. He did a great deal of his work, of course, in Wisconsin later in life, but a lot of his ideas about nature and about spending time in the outdoors did come from his early childhood in Iowa.
It sure did. He did spend the first 15 years of his life there along the banks of the Mississippi in Burlington, and exploring the rest of the countryside in and around Burlington. And he maintained his personal and professional connections really through his whole life. And of course, he was buried back there, back along the Mississippi River. But those formative years, growing up and exploring the Mississippi River bottoms along the river in Burlington, really did set the tone for all the work that he would do and all of his future writing and thinking about our relationship to the natural world.
Now, as he grew, he was an excellent student and pursued his education, but he was constantly being drawn to the outdoors and sometimes at the detriment of his schoolwork.
Well, he was an adventurous young guy, and he also grew up in a family that had deep ties to the landscape there in and around Burlington. Again, his grandfather was the immigrant from Germany who came over with many other actually German families that settled that region down there. And you look back through those generations, and it seems every generation in that family had very strong connections to the outdoors, whether it was through hunting or fishing or gardening or scientific exploration. It really was part of the family's ethic, and that would go on to shape Leopold's own commitment to conservation at the end of the 19th century, when there was no conservation movement yet, but already the family had a strong conservation ethic.
Well, and he decided he wanted to be a forester. In 1909, he was assigned to go work in Arizona and New Mexico. Can you give me an idea of, as you mentioned, there wasn't a conservation movement at that time. Can you paint me a picture of what our relationship with these vast tracts of wilderness that were still there at that time, what kind of relationship did humans in the United States have?
Yeah, well, I guess I would kind of work my way into that answer by saying, you know, put yourself in the upper Midwest in the late 19th century, and you would have seen a devastated landscape. The destruction of the northern forests in Michigan and Minnesota and Wisconsin, the depletion of wildlife populations across the country, and especially in the Mississippi River Valley, the the loss of soil, the destruction of the prairies of the Midwest, and conversion to agriculture. It was really a time of epic transformation. And so Leopold, growing up in Iowa at that time and seeing these changes and being sensitized to it, especially by his father, who was a real, as he called him later, a pioneer in conservation, he then, when he went out west with his first professional assignments with the U.S. Forest Service, he was then especially attentive then to what was still available there, which was these large tracts of wild landscape that we had lost here in the Midwest.
He had, of course, many moments in his life that shaped the way that he thought and shaped his later writings. One of those moments came when he was out west, and because ranchers in the area considered wolves to be a tremendous threat, that was part of the role, was to eradicate wolves from that area. What kind of an epiphany did he have?
Yeah, it's one of the most famous stories from Leopold's life. When, as a young forester, he was, going along with kind of the standards of the age, dedicated to the eradication of predators. And Leopold himself, of course, would become a real leader in the new science of wildlife ecology and wildlife management. But at that time, as the saying used to go, of course, the only good predator is a dead predator. So it took decades for Leopold to come to a new view, but there was this incident very early in his life where he himself shot and killed a wolf, and as he describes it in his famous essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, he approached this dying wolf and saw this green fire dying in the mother wolf's eyes, and he goes on to explain, there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to the wolf in the mountain. And it was really Leopold's understanding, kind of in an intuitive way, that these systems are much more complex than we understood at that point, and even that we understand now, and that humility is probably the best human response to understanding the mysteries of the natural world and our obligations to respect the functioning of those systems. And that would then feed into his own scientific work in, again, trying to understand better how wildlife populations and the landscape and humans in the landscape can and should work in harmony with each other.
He went on to pursue this field of study academically as a professor, as a researcher, but he also decided that he wanted to put into action the things that he was thinking about and learning about and studying. And even though he lived in Madison, Wisconsin, he decided to buy a farm that was considered to be spent.
Yeah, Leopold, one of the things that fascinates us, I think, continually about Leopold is how he's always combining action with thought and always playing off one against the other. And so he did in his later years, his family purchased a small acreage, an 88-acre farm here in Wisconsin, of what was he described as worn-out farmland, and it was land that had been farmed for a couple generations, but was really not even suitable for agriculture in the first place. And by the 1930s, a story common across so much of the U.S. and the Midwest had played out. It was pretty much a wasteland. And so Leopold and his family began the active work of ecological restoration and became a pioneer in that field, in particular restoring the native prairies and woodlands of our region here in Wisconsin. But it was a similar story across so much of the Midwest, including Iowa, where, again, having thoroughly disrupted the native ecosystems, at least beginning the effort to try to bring some of that back to the landscape and some of what Leopold began to call land health, the capacity of land to maintain its own healthy functioning. And that became, again, a revolutionary new act, very personal, though, for Leopold and his family. And his writing about those episodes in his book, A Sand County Almanac, is what would really translate this brand-new, rather abstract science of ecology into a way that any reader could understand and appreciate.
And sadly, he did not live to understand how incredibly powerful that book would become. That book was published after his death.
Yes, it was. In fact, it's a poignant story that just 1 week before he died, in the spring of 1948, he did get a phone call from New York, from Oxford University Press, telling him that they were interested in publishing his book, but he would pass away just 1 week later, and the book would be published a year after he died. And it would go on to sell, now we guess, somewhere in around 3 million copies, and really transform, the readers of the book would transform their views on our relationship to the land.
And this is a book that, of course, is still read by many people today. It's one of those works that for many people really shapes their ideas about ecology and about conservation and about our relationship with the natural world. And so often when I read his quotes or when I read his work, I am really struck by how modern he was in his thinking, how far ahead of his times he was.
Well, it really is extraordinary. I've been working on and reading Leopold for I don't know, 30-plus years now, and I can still go back to his writing after all of this time and still find fresh insights. And it has to do with the simplicity of his prose, but also the depth that simplicity kind of hides, because he really did think in layers of meaning and conveyed that through his clear and powerful writing. And he had the scientific insight, but he also had the poet's touch. And it's the poetry that really makes it lasting for us. And again, combined with his own action and this really remarkable legacy, it's not just his writing as a teacher, as a father, father to an extraordinary family of conservation leaders and scientists himself. Through the institutions he worked with, through the professional relationships he had. And I might add that Iowa in particular benefited from a lot of this through Leopold's connections there that, again, did extend throughout his whole life. And I'm really delighted to see right now, actually, that our friends down in Burlington have really, in the last few years, reclaimed a lot of that legacy and are bringing it back to life in some wonderful new ways down there in the southeast corner of the state.
So we have just about 30 seconds left. If there was one thing that you would want everyone to know about Aldo Leopold, what would it be?
Oh, boy. I think it would be that he understood that understanding our relationship to the land is fundamental to everything we are, we do, that we care about. He didn't think of himself as having the last word on this. In fact, his work was an invitation, really, to all of us to think about the fundamentals of our economy, of our ecological well-being, and of our culture and our rootage in the land. And that can be a wonderful new way of understanding our not only our human-land relationships, but our communities and their well-being as well.
Kurt, thank you so much.
Charity, thank you, and good luck with the rest of the program today.
Thank you very much. Kurt Miney, we've been talking about conservationist Aldo Leopold of Burlington, Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Again, this is Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa and River to River. And this hour, we are focusing on conservationists from Iowa. We were just talking about Aldo Leopold. And now we're going to turn to a man who was a contemporary of Aldo Leopold's. He also did most of his most important work outside of Iowa. His name is Ernest Oberholzer. He was born in Davenport in 1884. Much of his important conservation work was done well north of here. And Beth Waterhouse is here with me today. She is the executive director of the Ernest Oberholzer Foundation. Hello, Beth.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, let's go back to Ernest Oberholzer's early life in Davenport, Iowa. He had a very difficult start in many ways. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, Ernest Oberholzer is one of the greats when it comes to the final result of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, the region of the Quetico and where it touches Minnesota. But yes, his years in Davenport were tough years for a young guy. I was so happy just now to listen to Kurt Meine and to see how many parallels there were between Leopold in his years growing up in Burlington. With Oberholzer, the Mississippi River was also a very important factor, and his formative years there again in Iowa really set the tone. His grandfather was also straight from Germany, and much like Leopold, Oberholzer lived at that very time that Kurt was talking about, where timber and soil and prairies were changing and there was so much depletion that was obvious to those paying attention.
And his early life was not only spent exploring the Mississippi River watershed, but also was a time of tremendous loss for him. His brother died, his father died, and then as he pursued his education, he almost died.
Right. So one of the fun stories of life in Davenport that I think worth telling was after the sad loss of Frank, his brother at five, who fell and hit his head and did not make it through that, Ober and his, who wasn't called Ober then, he was called Ernest, but Ernest and his mother, Rosa, would often go to the cemetery in Davenport to visit Frank's grave. And there, Ernest met up with a quite unique individual named Tom Burke, who was an Irish grave digger in the cemetery, who took a liking to Ernest, and together they explored the area, Duck Creek and the pasturelands near the cemetery. And Burke must have been quite a guy. He, Ober later said, his Irish superstitions and his humanity and his kindness, his disregard of money, all of that made quite a mark on young Ober. So, yes, one never knows in our young life. Later on, of course, Oberholzer went north and started working on wilderness policy himself.
And he, as I mentioned, he nearly died. He was not in good health, and he came down with rheumatic fever, and a doctor told him he had a year to live. That was a very a big turning point for him, and not exactly in the way that many of us would imagine.
Can you imagine how that would affect your life, to be told at age 17 that you have a year? I imagine every year for so many years beyond that, Oberholzer would think about, you know, whether this indeed was his last. But he chose to really work against that, and he went north. He started canoeing. He met up with a wonderful Ojibwe guide named Billy McGee, and together they paddled and portaged 3,000 miles in 1 year and then 2,000 miles up to Hudson Bay and back. So he really paddled his way to strength. 50 years later, however, he came back to that diagnosis after the rheumatic fever, and he said that that made probably the biggest impact on his life, because he valued his health and he kept sort of working against that diagnosis all these years.
So we talked a little bit in the last segment when we were talking about Aldo Leopold, about what was going on in the United States, and particularly in the Midwest during this time when Ernest Oberholzer and Aldo Leopold were young men. And one of the big things, of course, is that the all of the great forests of Michigan were basically clear-cut, and the trees of Wisconsin were basically clear-cut. And Iowa, of course, didn't have a lot of trees, but we had even fewer by that time. And there were fires that were raging across the grasslands, and it was really a barren landscape in many ways. Now, way up north in Minnesota, where Oberholzer did his greatest work, there were still trees, and he loved that wilderness. But how... what did he do to protect those trees and that land?
Well, there were still trees, although there was an awful lot of cutting going on and log booms everywhere and trees floating in lakes more than perhaps standing on the edges of the lakes. But I think one of the key times when Oberholzer was pulled in was In 1925, a man named Edward Wellington Backus, who indeed developed much of the towns and area up there, Backus made a proposal to the International Joint Commission, which was Canada-U.S., to flood a huge region and essentially lose a lot of the wilderness in that whole Quetico region. His proposal was for hydropower. And Oberholzer was chosen by a number of leaders to be the spearhead of that movement. And the fact that he dedicated his young years, his 30s, his 40s, and on into his 50s, directly working on that proposal and trying to pass legislation that would protect that region from flooding and really any region from that sort of industrialist pressure is really quite amazing.
That is remarkable. And he also was a great student of Ojibwe culture, and he worked also to protect the culture of Native Americans.
Yes, you've hit it right on the head. I think that his biggest motivation, especially after the initial push for against the Backus proposal, which was more against something perhaps, but when he was asked what he stood for, it was often the health and rejuvenation and continuation of the powerful cultures that he met up there with the Rainy Lake Ojibwe and essentially the Anishinaabe people in that area. He went in, he would paddle into a village, perhaps with Billy McGee in the stern of his canoe, but perhaps not, and he would ask for stories. He would sit down with the Indians and try to learn their language. And so even as a young man, he somehow knew that you don't walk in and tell people what to do. You get to know them first. And he definitely did that, made a lot of friends. Later in his life, these Ojibwe friends would be the labor that he needed to keep his island going. And he often said that the loss of their knowledge on the land was the biggest loss that the land was suffering up there. And when he later talked about his quote-unquote University of the Wilderness, he meant, and this is what we're trying to interpret, is how to bring the indigenous knowledge of the land back to it, how to reinvigorate that connection as much as we can, or, you know, just hook to it in some way.
Well, and I mentioned that he was a contemporary of Aldo Leopold's, and they actually knew each other, and they were both members of the founding of the Wilderness Committee.
Yeah, that's right. They were two of the eight that founded the Wilderness Society. Leopold would come more than once to Mallard Island, but I know in 1947, July, he spent a few days on Mallard Island, which was Ober's home in Rainy Lake, and they made policy there. In fact, Leopold was coming to that time when he understood the full value of the predator, and the wolf question was on his mind one time when he was sitting on Ober's Island. So, yep, they knew each other and worked together. So sadly, we lost Aldo Leopold at such a young age, and Oberholzer lived on to age 93. So he became an old man of the movement in some ways.
Right. He died in 1977.
1977.
Well, Beth, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, you're welcome, and thanks for doing this, Charity.
Beth Waterhouse is the executive director of the Ernest Oberholzer Foundation. He is well known in Minnesota, although he is originally from Davenport, Iowa, and right now he's the subject of an exhibition at Davenport's German American Heritage Center that's on display through October 27th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This hour we're talking about some of Iowa's most influential conservationists. This is not an exhaustive list of Iowa conservationists, but we'll move on now to talk about a man Major John Fletcher Lacy. He has been called the father of American conservation. He was born in Virginia in 1841, but he moved to Oskaloosa, Iowa when he was 14 years old. He served as U.S. representative for Iowa's 6th District for 16 years. And with me to talk about his work and his legacy is Jerry Schnepp, who is executive director of Keep Iowa Beautiful. Hello, Jerry.
Greetings, Charity. Appreciate being on with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk a little bit about Major John Fletcher Lacy. Now, he did serve during the Civil War, right?
Exactly. He served during the whole Civil War period. So he went beyond his term of service and continued to serve there in many ways. So it's just reflection on his depth of commitment to causes.
And he became a politician in Iowa. I mentioned that he served in Congress, but he served in a number of other roles as well.
Well, he served, I'll tell you what, you can go through the list. He served in the U.S. or the Iowa House of Representatives. He served as a city council member. He's an attorney, a statesman, a bricklayer and a mason, a citizen, a husband, a city council member, any defender of human rights, a city attorney, an author, Civil War hero, conservationist, and a national leader, and above all, he was an Iowan.
And he has a lot of tremendous accomplishments to his name in the field of conservation. We'll talk about some of those in particular, but do we have an idea of where his commitment to public land and conservation came from?
Well, one of the things is, frankly, he traveled every state and every territory of the United States. He traveled internationally, and in those travels, he saw things happening with the countryside and the landscape that bothered him greatly. And even on his trip as a youngster when he was 14 years old, from Keokuk to Oskaloosa, you know, he saw things there as well with regard to the prairies and the forests. So, you know, he picked it up by natural instinct, seeing it at firsthand and experiencing it.
And he served, when he was in Congress, he served for 12 years as the chairman of the Committee on Public Lands. Was that a seat that he sought out?
Well, I think it was because, and not only sought out, but I think people sought him out because of his deep knowledge and the fact that he understood the countryside and the land and this country far better than a lot of the other legislators. So I wasn't there at the time, but you know he had his following, and at many times he was not truly respected. One of his acts, I don't know if you want to start talking about, was the Lacy Bird Law, which is in 1900, and it's the law that prevents the interstate shipment of illegally taken game or wildlife. It's probably the most effective law today for enforcement for wildlife officials across the United States. And here, think of that. That's a century plus.
Right, and we still depend on that now.
Still depend on it.
What were some of the things that he saw? I know that there was a controversy around Yellowstone National Park that he saw a problem, and that's one of the things that the Lacy Act grew out of. Can you describe that for us?
Well, in fact, there's a lot of things that one of the things they saw, deforestation, he saw acts of taking game out of the forest, literally out of the national park areas or potential national park areas. He saw a lot of illegal actions against the natural resources, against that heritage. He experienced it firsthand. And, Charity, I'm not sure of the depth here. All I can remember is one particular story that as he read his book or the book about him, at the turn of the century, you talked about conservation. It was not on the tips of tongues of everybody, and it was not viewed very positively because we were in an exploitive nature for this country. We were growing. We were dependent upon harvesting timber for the railroads, and he ended up being a railroad attorney. I found that interesting. But we were utilizing the resources as fast as we could, consuming them to grow the country. And he was speaking before a women's club at the turn of the century, a state meeting of the Iowa Women's Club. And when you looked across that audience, all these ladies were wearing these hats with the colorful plumes of birds, feathers, all those kinds of things. So he said in one of his comments, and it's not exactly correct, but it went like this. We now have a crownless king. We have a thornless cactus. We have a coreless apple. Please let us have a featherless hat. I never found out whether they applauded or ran him out of the room. I never did follow up what happened there, but I thought that was a fairly aggressive statement on his part.
Brave, very brave in front of that room, it sounds like.
Right. Interesting. So it shows, again, his commitment.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back, and we will talk more about John Fletcher Lacy, who has been called the father of American conservation. He was, as I mentioned, born in Virginia, but he moved to Oskaloosa, Iowa, and he served in many different capacities in the state of Iowa and practiced law in Oskaloosa. He served as U.S. Representative for Iowa's 6th District for 16 years, and I'm talking with Jerry Schnepf, who's Executive Director of Keep Iowa Beautiful. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment, and then, of course, we will go on to talk about other conservationists from Iowa, including Ada Hayden and Lewis Pamel. And we would love to hear from you as well. If you have a conservationist from Iowa who did significant work in Iowa, who was born in Iowa, that you consider to be tremendously influential, write a few lines about that. Send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Again, that email address, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Week continues, and today at noon on River to River, we'll talk about influential Iowans in the field of medicine. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about influential Iowa conservationists as we celebrate Iowa Week this week on Talk of Iowa and River to River. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about the work of Ada Hayden. But right now, we're focusing on the work of Major John Fletcher Lacy. He was also a U.S. representative for Iowa's 6th District for 16 years. And with me to talk about him is Jerry Schnepf, Executive Director of Keep Iowa Beautiful. We've already talked about the fact that the Lacy Act of 1900 is still used today. This was an act that was codified to protect both plants and wildlife by creating civil and criminal penalties for a wide array of violations. It is still protecting wildlife and wild areas today. And Jerry, another act that he was behind and is still significant today is the Antiquities Act. Tell me about that.
I would say that probably the Antiquities Act, Charity, is probably the most significant piece of legislation for conservation that you can imagine. It authorized and gave the authority to the presidents to set aside public lands for national areas at the stroke of a pen. There was no need to go to Congress, no need for any congressional actions, anything of that nature. And presidents did utilize that tool. Millions of acres were set aside as a result of that Antiquities Act, which was set up for archaeological and unique areas across the country. And he, again, that's probably even more significant in a way than the Lacy Bird Law. Well, they're both significant. You can't underrate either one of them. But tremendous efforts on the part of Major Lacy.
He, of course, that act was signed into law by Theodore Roosevelt. And when we think about the large tracts of land in the West that were set aside, a lot of us do think about Theodore Roosevelt. But, of course, Lacy did this work that made it possible for that to be signed into law. When I think of the father of American conservation, I guess John Fletcher Lacy's not the first man who comes to mind. Why do you think that his work is not as well remembered?
You know, I really don't know that. Yeah, I've questioned that in my mind too, Charity. You know, there's a lot of ways to influence and to make change. Writings like Aldo Leopold influence people. Visuals like J.N. Ding Darling influence people. And here's a man put things into action, very specific actions, and yet did not carry on in history, at least to the level that I think he should. And I don't know that I can really answer that. I don't have a feel for that charity and why that didn't happen.
So I know that he's been a major influence on you and someone who you remember.
Well,
his,
absolutely.
His legacy. But so if there was one thing that you would want everyone to know about this man, what would it be?
So the key thing is, Major Lacy serves as inspiration to all of us. To youth, he serves to inspire that you can make a difference through the right kind of efforts and diligence of time and through commitment. And for us adults, it's a reminder of what we can do to be supportive of his legacy. So it's a dual effort here for both young and old that he sets the standard. I just claim him as my hero, my conservation hero. There's a lot of other great people, and I don't mean to diminish them, but for me, this is the man that put things into action, and he did so without asking for any credit or recognition, although the names of the acts are all named after him, and we have a state park named after him, Lacy State Park, and so on, so Lacy Keosauqua. So, you know, he's getting some recognition, but again, it's just an effort that we got to keep in front of people like you're doing, Charity.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Charity. Appreciate it.
Jerry Schnepp is Executive Director of Keep Iowa Beautiful. And, of course, we've been talking about Major John Fletcher Lacy, who has been called the father of American conservation. And we're going to turn now to a woman whose name a lot of people in central Iowa are familiar with, but whose name is probably not well known around the rest of the state or around the rest of the nation. Most of Iowa's native prairie, of course, was plowed under to make way for agriculture, but long before the idea of prairie reconstruction became popular, there were those who were working to make sure that some of our native prairie survived. Ada Hayden was one of those individuals. Deborah Lewis is the curator of the Ada Hayden Herbarium in Ames, Iowa, and she is with me now. Hello, Deb.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be on your show today.
And Ada Hayden was born in 1884, so again, a contemporary of many of the people we've been talking about this hour, of Aldo Leopold and Ernest Oberholzer. And that was not a time when a lot of women went on to pursue higher education. Tell me about this young woman and her interest in education.
Well, she did grow up in Ames, and she was encouraged by Lewis Pamel to come to Iowa State and study botany. And so she got her bachelor's degree in 1908. She went off to St. Louis, which was the only time she lived away from Ames, to get her master's degree from Washington University in 1910. And then she came back and got a second master's degree here in 1911. In the meantime, Iowa State started its doctoral program, and she was one of the first to get involved with that, again, with Pamel's support. And in 1918, she became the first woman to get a PhD at Iowa State.
Wow. And tell me a little bit about her early experiences with nature and with prairies. How did this interest come about?
Well, first of all, she grew up on a farm just north of Ames that had a prairie and wetland area that was set aside and was not plowed or used in agriculture. So that was her playground as she grew up, and I think that strongly influenced her love of prairies for the rest of her life. And her both her master's degree here at Iowa State and her doctoral work was on prairie plants. So she did get off to an early start in studying prairies and especially the plants that occur on the prairies.
Now, we've in past shows when we've talked about prairie reconstruction, we've talked about the fact that there are not a lot of documents that tell us what the native prairie plants were. So there are probably species that had been lost before anyone was documenting them. Were there other people doing this work, trying to document these native plants at the same time, or was she one of the first?
Well, she was among the first, but even earlier, Thomas McBride at the University of Iowa and his colleague, Bahumil Shimek, and here at Iowa State, Charles Bessie and Lewis Pamel were all engaged in studying Iowa's plants. Now, that was in the latter part of the 1800s, so who knows, as you said, what might have been lost earlier than that.
And she dedicated much of her energy to protecting these tracts of prairie that remained. How did she go about that?
Well, she, in the 1940s, she got a grant of $100 from the Iowa Academy of Science. And with that, she traveled around the state looking at the various kinds of prairie. And she selected 22 sites that she thought best represented Iowa's sand prairies and river bottom deep soil prairies and other kinds of prairies throughout the state. And she proposed those to the state to be purchased and set aside as state preserves.
Did she have support in this effort?
Well, by the time of her death in 1950, three of those prairies were indeed purchased by the state as state preserves. And the Lime Springs Prairie up in Howard County was named in her honor shortly after her death in 1950.
Well, and as I mentioned, there are people in Ames who are well aware of her now, largely because of Ada Hayden Park, which is on the north side of Ames. I lived in Hayden Hall when I was going to school.
Yes.
In Maple Willow Larch, but I didn't know who that hall was named after. What do you think is important about people actually learning her name and learning a little bit more about her legacy?
Well, certainly the persistence that she had. I mean, she started out even as early as 1918, right after getting her doctorate, in pushing for prairie preserves, even while the primary focus at that time was getting the state parks system going. But she was there speaking out for preserving prairies as owned by the state and protected and set aside. And obviously, this was a much harder sell than the idea of having a state park where people could go camp in campgrounds and have shade and maybe a lake for swimming and boating and fishing and those sorts of things. We can imagine a prairie being a place just to visit for nature study, for maybe photography, birds, insects, plants, you know, all of those wonderful things. But as I say, that was a much harder sell than state parks.
Right. Well, and let's move on and talk a little bit about state parks, because you have mentioned a number of times already Lewis Pamel, who was a great botanist, and he was one of Ada Hayden's teachers. He was also one of George Washington Carver's professors. So this was a man who was extremely influential in the world of botany.
He certainly was, and he was influential across the state, a sort of a one-man extension service in his day as well.
Really? Tell me how that worked.
Well, certainly with Iowa State being the land-grant institution and his interests in botany and plants in all sorts of ways, whether that be for our natural heritage or for agriculture. So he traveled around the state. He received many, many letters and requests for information and answers to farmers' questions. So this gained him a lot of popularity and support around the state. And I think that that helped him to accomplish as much as he did.
And he was influential in creating Iowa's state park system. What was his role?
Well, first of all, even earlier, he had worked with Thomas McBride and Bahumil Shimek, as I mentioned earlier, at the University of Iowa. And together, they took an interest in trying to set aside lands to protect them. And finally, by 1918, the state legislature was starting to come around, and he had spoken very vigorously on behalf of state parks to the state legislature. And he also called together a group of citizens from around the state, including a lot of the women from the Federated Women's Clubs of Iowa. And he engaged them, as I believe that Jerry Schnepf was talking about John Lacey, also talking to the same group and getting them engaged in conservation in all sorts of ways and getting behind the state parks idea. And he went out and surveyed, much as Ada Hayden did for prairies, he surveyed a lot of the state's areas and pushed for the setting aside of such areas as backbone, ledges, and many other parks around the state.
Iowa does not have as much public land as many other states, although we do have some very, very special places, which you've just mentioned a lot of. We also are not a place that is known for our wilderness. But this whole hour, we've talked about some of the people who really shaped the environmental movement in the United States, shaped conservation, and made it possible to protect lands not just in Iowa, but all over the country. In your work and in talking about Ada Hayden and thinking about these other conservationists like Shimek, like McBride, like Pamel from Iowa, why do you think Iowa has such a strong conservation legacy in this way?
Well, for one thing, we've seen the lands change. Again, Jerry Schnepf mentioned this about John Lacey, that seeing the changes happen on the lands, whether that be on the national scene for Lacey or on Iowa's local scene for these other conservationists we've been talking about, it encourages setting aside lands to protect them as examples of what Iowa had as part of its heritage. And that's both cultural heritage as well as its natural heritage.
Why do you think it's important that we remember these names?
Well, it's they certainly are wonderful examples of perseverance, of going beyond just their research and teaching and all to really taking an active interest in engaging the public, in speaking out, and in trying to get these changes made. And they serve as role models for the rest of us.
Absolutely. Do you find that people are surprised when you start to tell them about some of this work?
Yes, I do. The people a lot of times don't know a lot about our conservation heritage, and whether that be on the national scene or on the local scene. And shows such as yours in getting the word out is certainly a big help in helping people to come to understand and respect the work that these folks did.
Well, and hopefully it'll also work to inspire the next generation of Iowa conservationists.
We've seen a lot of students here at Iowa State take a very active interest and role in figuring out new ways for improved agriculture, for, again, protecting our lands, for finding out what we have here in the state, and for ongoing protection of what we do have.
Deb Lewis, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Charity.
Deb Lewis is the curator of the Ada Hayden Herbarium in Ames, Iowa. And all this hour, we've been talking about some of the many conservationists from Iowa who have been incredibly influential in the state and around the nation as well. This is Iowa Week, and all this week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we are talking about innovative, influential, remarkable Iowans in many different fields. So today was conservation on Talk of Iowa, and with me, the host of River to River, Ben Kiefer, coming up today at noon. What are you focusing on today?
Well, this afternoon we'll be talking about remarkable Iowans as it pertains to medicine and medical history in Iowa, and we can't do that without talking about Ignacio Ponseti and the Ponseti International Association, a remarkable, nearly miraculous treatment that he developed. He died a few years ago to treat the congenital condition known as club foot. It affects nearly 200,000 babies a year. And very proud that Iowa is connected with a treatment for that. But we'll be having five medical doctors total during the noon hour to talk about much more than the Ponseti International Association. We'll also talk about the Iowa-based statewide perinatal care program and how that was developed in the 1970s, the early 1970s. So if you're interested in that, stay tuned.
All right. That's coming up on River to River today at noon. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we're going to talk about Iowa musicians. Meredith Wilson, Dvorak, Bix Beiderbecke, to name just a few. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns and Rick Fredrickson. This is Talk of Iowa.